Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with Pastor William Fink, for another installation of Yahweh's Covenant People. And tonight we're going to start with the first epistle of Peter. And as usual, I'm going to be quoting from the King James Version. I have an expanded King James Version with commentaries beginning with in each chapter. And so I'll start quoting here, unless, Bill, you have kind of preliminary comments before we get into Peter.
No, I really don't have anything that's too preliminary. It's evident that from the opening verses of Peter that he is writing to the dispersion in all of the places where Paul founded his where Paul founded his assemblies.
Okay.
He's writing, you know, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia, Galatia. That's all Western Anatolia,
mm-hmm.
where Paul founded his assemblies.
Right.
And I believe since Silvanus apparently bore this letter, okay, if we look at chapter 5
mm-hmm.
in 1 Timothy, by Silvanus, the faithful brother, as I reckon I have written to you in a brief exhorting and testifying for this to be the true favor of Yahweh. In other words, Silvanus is delivering this letter, and he was mentioned, and he was with Paul, if it's the same Silvanus, right? And he's mentioned in 2 Corinthians and in both epistles to the Thessalonians. So if he delivered this letter, it's very possible that he went to visit Timothy. And I believe that Timothy was in Babylon as the closing to this epistle indicates, this 1 Timothy indicates, 5:13. The elect woman in Babylon and Marcus, my son, greet you.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that there was a Mark with Peter. And I believe that the Gospel of Mark may have been written by that Mark. I personally can't prove it, but it's other people have also professed this, that the Gospel of Mark is probably Peter's Gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was Comparé's position also. And it seems to make sense. Now the we can't date this letter. It can't be dated. I tend to believe that it may have been written as a reinforcing letter because of what we see that wherever Paul went, there was division with the Judaizers.
Right.
And it's my personal opinion. It can't be established from scripture or history, but it's my personal opinion that Peter wrote to these uncircumcised of the diaspora
mm-hmm.
in Paul's districts where Paul founded his epistles in order to address some of the Judaizers.
Okay.
And we will see that Peter's epistles consistently support everything that Paul wrote.
Okay.
But
yes.
This epistle, there's a lot of overlap here with Paul's epistles, and
yes.
I have quite a few.
Yeah, immediately. Yes, there is. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, and there's no doubt about that. And that's the same with James. We noticed that a lot, that there's a lot of overlap with James, and that they really aren't teaching anything different.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like Paul is teaching something different, but that's because, Paul has a slightly different definition of the word faith, which includes obedience to the law, okay?
Right, with James, they're two separate distinct.
Right, and, you have to read carefully to figure that out, you know, and because Paul was actually an Israelite of the dispersion of the tribe of Benjamin, that he had a different terminology very often, and we have to take that into consideration. He was not an Israelite of Judea. He was a Benjamite from Tarsus, which is in what, central
well,
Turkey.
Well, his learning was Peter was unlearned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm certain that James was unlearned too. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's by their own admission in the book of Acts.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not any sort of slander. They were simple fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
That they were probably about as educated as your average fisherman today, right?
Right.
That's not very much, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most of the guys I knew that were professional fishermen, that they left school and started when they were 14.
Right.
And that's
yeah.
the way it is. And Peter and John working for their father and fishing the Sea of Galilee as the Gospels attest, they were probably much in the same position.
Right, right. Probably illiterate.
Paul was raised in Tarsus, which according to Strabo what was one of the three great cities of learning of the Greek world.
Mm-hmm.
Right
mm-hmm.
there with Athens and Alexandria.
Yeah.
And
so
Paul was also received a special education in Jerusalem, as he says, at the feet of Gamaliel.
Right, yes.
And now a lot of people want to blaspheme this Gamaliel. But if you really study the portion of the book of Acts where Gamaliel gives the Sanhedrin counsel on what to do with Christianity,
mm-hmm.
you'll see that Gamaliel actually gave very very wise
okay.
advice.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, not all the Pharisees were Edomites, and not all the and some of the Pharisees, probably Nicodemus, was an Israelite, and obviously Paul was. Some people want to count him as a Pharisee.
Well, Nicodemus was certainly an Israelite. The gospel attests that he actually helped Joseph of Arimathea with the body of Christ.
Right, right. And as we've pointed out many times, it's like the difference between, in modern times, between a Republican and a Zionist. Okay.
Well, absolutely,
yeah.
Or progressive Democrat, which is the
right.
way I look at the Sadducees, that the rejecters of all religion.
Right, right, and obviously Joseph of Arimathea, being a member of the Sanhedrin, he was probably one of the few truly good men on the Sanhedrin. Okay, because obviously under the Herods, the Edomites had taken virtually total control of the politics and religion of Judea, you know, but nevertheless, there were holdouts, which we, you know, you and I have been referring to them as traditionalists.
Well, they were. And,
yeah.
and, you know, Paul was able to cause great division amongst the Sanhedrin.
Right.
Based on religious grounds.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, because you had the Sadducees, the Pharisees, they had the differences in doctrine. Most of the Sadducees appear to have been also Edomites or even
Well, well, I think all the Sadducees were Edomites.
Okay.
The high priest, it's proven in Acts chapters 4 and 5, the high priests were of a distinct race, if you read my translation,
uh-huh.
than the apostles, okay? And they were also certainly Sadducees. It's explicit in the Acts that the high priests who were in charge of the temple when Christ was crucified were Sadducees. They
yeah.
were not Pharisees. If you really examine the gospel,
okay.
you will find that Christ never addressed the Sadducees.
Mm-hmm.
The word Sadducee is never recorded as coming from his mouth. There were times in the gospel when the Sadducees accosted and questioned him.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
He addressed the Pharisees quite often. And he even ate and dined with certain Pharisees, but he never even addressed the Sadducees.
Okay.
And never spoke to them unless they accosted him.
Sure. Okay.
So the Sadducees, I think, were the Chuck Schumers and the Al D'Amatos and the neocons that are beyond hope.
Right.
They're Edomites.
Yeah, the modern Zionists, yeah.
They're the modern-day progressives, you know, they call themselves progressives in the name of perversion.
Right.
And the Hillary Clintons, and they're beyond hope.
Yeah.
I believe they were all Edomites.
And they didn't believe in an afterlife, just as Jews don't believe in an afterlife.
well, right. They denied the afterlife. They denied the spirit,
right.
the spiritual world. If you deny the spiritual world, you're in essence denying God.
They didn't go so far as to say
that explicitly,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Apparently.
Yeah. So we make a distinction between the Judahites who happened to be in league with the Edomite Pharisees and Sadducees, okay, who in many cases were, you know, deceived by them, but were in fact Judahites and of true Israel, versus the Edomites who had taken over the country and were non-Israelites, plain non-Israelites. And they're the ones who practiced and invented the religion called Judaism. So the real Judaizers are always the Edomites and the Canaanites. And, of course, they have allies in our group, you know, who are actually of our own race, okay? So when we're talking about Judaizers, we're talking about Edomites and, of course, some potentially Judahites and Benjamites who, you know, were either employees of theirs or who were full-fledged Pharisees.
Right. There were many full – I mean, Paul was a full-fledged Pharisee.
Right.
But after his fathers were. just like the Republican Party, the Democratic Party of today, at one time it started out with good intentions,
mm-hmm.
and it was formed with good intentions, and it was subverted and perverted and,
right.
and usurped.
Yes.
And look at the Republicans today. How many good white men and women are really conservative, they consider themselves? Some of them consider themselves neocons. They don't even know what it means.
Right.
To be a neocon.
Yeah,
they have no clue what they're saying.
Yes.
They don't even know that. They don't even know that these original neocons
yeah.
were all 60s radical
mm-hmm.
liberal commie hippies.
Marxists, exactly.
They all were.
University of Chicago, exactly, yes.
They all were, every one of them without exception. They were
mm-hmm.
all Marxist hippies in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
That called themselves neocons because not because it was some sort of new conservative, but because they had newly become conservative
right.
just in order to usurp the Republican Party.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what they've done, you know, because they had owned the Democratic Party since the days of Woodrow Wilson.
Well, right. And they wanted to get a grip on the Republican Party, so
right.
so they formed the neocons,
yeah.
and basically they did usurp it and take
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So in modern terms, a Judaizer would be an actual Jewish person who is a Zionist / communist / Pharisee. Et cetera, et cetera.
Well, right. And our people go along with them all the time.
That's right.
And like I always say, there's going to be a lot of our people that are going to be mad
mm-hmm.
at God.
That's right, right.
Because
they're
mad at God.
Yeah.
When the tares are rooted up and thrown in the fire, a lot of our people are going to say, how dare you do that to your people?
Yes. Yeah.
How dare you hurt those poor oppressed people?
They're your chosen. Right. Okay. So let me go proceed to the survey here, and I want to identify several words here that this author uses, which are, of course, Church Greek, okay? He starts out saying, this beautiful letter was written to Christians in Asia Minor to stimulate in them a joyful hope in the face of coming persecution. It was intended to be circulated among Christians of predominantly Gentile heritage. Okay, and by he means by Gentiles, non-Israelites. Of course, we know that the people he's addressing, as you pointed out already, are members of the dispersion of those congregations established by Paul.
Well, that's absolutely true. And let me say that if this letter were to the Jews or to the circumcision, do you really think we'd have it today?
No.
Well, why don't we have any of the letters to the circumcision?
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, if it were written to the Jews, they would have destroyed it.
Well, of course. Or
yeah.
the circumcision, and the Jews would have got their hands on it.
Right. Right. Okay. So it was intended to be circulated among Christians of predominantly dispersed Israelite stock in congregations located in provinces of the Roman Empire, where the imperial yoke was apt to be most severe. Persecution was not unknown to the church. Okay, that's the understatement of the century. And it should be persecution was not unknown to the assemblies.
Well, right. And 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul makes it very clear that they're being persecuted. And he even uses a phrase which means because of the present violence.
Mm-hmm.
When he's advising that maybe people don't want to get married.
Right.
Because of the present violence.
Yes.
And that's exactly why he's doing that in 1 Corinthians 7. And everybody misses it. And
mm-hmm.
tries to find that Paul's against marriage or something because of the poor translation of the King James Version of the Bible there.
Right, right. Okay, next sentence. From the early persecution of Stephen and the dispersion that followed, and Stephen was persecuted by Jews, by Edomite Jews, no doubt about it. And, of course, Paul participated in that.
Well, I'm sure a lot of traditionalists did.
Yes. To the constant harassment of Paul wherever he went, the early Christians knew the strain and tension of antagonism, and so do we identists today. Now the wrath of the demented Emperor Nero was about to explode in Rome at the expense of the church. Here he uses it, you know, Paul never uses the word church, at the expense of the congregations. Therefore, the Apostle Peter tried to prepare the congregations in Asia Minor for imminent disaster in these eastern provinces where oppression would undoubtedly spread from its source in Rome. In the spirit of a faithful shepherd and bishop of souls, Peter sent this pastoral letter to confirm his flock in the comforting hope of the Spirit's coming. Are you aware that Peter was ever formally ordained or considered to be a bishop of any congregation?
Well, no. I mean, the confusion of apostles as bishops and the naming of Peter and Paul as bishops of Rome is just ridiculous Roman.
Yeah, it's just an invention.
It's a pure contrivance by the Roman Church.
Uh-huh, right. Okay, being rooted in the passions of Christ, they are to abstain from the passions of the flesh. If they find themselves in a hostile society, their suffering for righteousness' sake will actually be a blessing. Okay, so except for the Church Greek terminology, not too bad an intro. So let's go. First letter of Peter, chapter 1, verse 1. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the strangers scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Now, of course, in the past, in other episodes, especially in the letters of Paul, we have found that this word translated as stranger often is an adjective meaning estranged. Is that the case here?
Well no, it's not.
Okay.
The problem is that the word scattered is actually a noun.
Okay.
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 The word strangers is a verb here, and the verb scattered is actually a noun.
Oh, okay. That's the question. So it's a little bit different here. We have scattered should be the noun, to the scattered.
This letter is to the elect sojourners
okay.
of the dispersion of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia.
Mm-hmm.
The elect, the Greek word dispersion is the word diaspora,
mm-hmm.
and it's a noun, and it's only used in the New Testament on two other occasions.
Hmm.
With John, who was speaking of the Greeks, will he go to the diaspora or the dispersion of the Greeks and teach the Greeks?
Right.
And to James, in his address to the 12 tribes.
Right.
Now this word appears in 2 Maccabees once, and it appears in the prophets several times. It's always about the children of Israel.
Right.
The ones that were taken away by the Assyrians and
yes.
the Babylonians. Never does this word appear in biblical writing, speaking of the Judeans or so-called Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, the word parapedamus is stranger here. And it's in my translation, it's sojourner.
Okay.
Because it correctly defines in Greek one who leaves his land and travels in a strange country.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Now, wherever it appears elsewhere in Greek scripture, it's not talking about the world. It's talking about the Adamic race on earth.
Sure.
Genesis 23:4, Psalm 38:12 in the Septuagint, 39:12 in the King James, Hebrews 11:13, and 1 Peter 2:11. Peter defines sojourner there by his use of paroikos, a synonym rendered here as sojourner in verse 17, and both words appear together in 1 Peter 2:11.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So we see, it, if we read 17, verse 17 and the verse at 2:11, verse 17 surely informs us that by sojourner, Peter means an Adamic spirit on this earth. And that's who he's addressing here, to
yeah.
the elect Adamic spirits on this earth of the dispersion, referring to the Israelite dispersion.
Mm-hmm.
That the Israelite dispersion is always the context where that
yes.
word is used in Scripture.
And no one else could possibly be a member of the elect.
Oh, and we're going to show that over and over again in Peter's letter
right.
here. And he says so explicitly. Now the Judeo, we have, I'm sorry, an opening verse 2, we have, according to the foreknowledge of the Father. And I have one note on that before you read it.
Okay.
The Judeo-Christians love to talk about the foreknowledge of the Father.
Yes.
But then they refuse to admit that the foreknowledge of the Father is revealed in the prophets.
Right.
As Paul tells us
and
in Romans.
And exclusively to and about Israel.
Well,
yes.
well right. In Romans chapter 1, verses 1 to 2, Paul uses very similar language where he says, which he previously announced through his prophets in the sacred writings,
mm-hmm.
talking about the gospel of Yahweh. And that throughout those writings, those sacred writings in the prophets, that's where we find the foreknowledge of the Father. Anybody who claims to have foreknowledge of the Father outside of the prophets is lying
mm-hmm.
and making up his own religion.
Right.
And yet, you know, we find throughout these writings nothing but salvation, redemption, and eternal life are a promise to nobody but to the
mm-hmm.
physical and legitimate children of Israel. And we'll see that Peter also says that here.
Yeah, yeah. So the correct translation in verse 1 to the sojourning dispersion?
Well, to the elect sojourners of the dispersion.
Okay.
Which is the genitive case.
Right.
Of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia.
Okay. So dispersion. Now, one of the few places, you just mentioned two other places where the word dispersed is actually used of the Christian Israelites of the era here, is in John 7:35. Let me just quote it here. Then said the Judeans among themselves, where will he go? And because this, we're talking about the Pharisees huddling together as Jews are wont to do and confabbing here. Where will he go that we shall not find him? Will he go to the dispersed among the nations and teach the nations?
Now that sounds good, but what it really says in Greek is, will he go to the dispersed of the Greeks and teach the Greeks?
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
It was a lot. I think it was better understood then than it is now. The Greek culture and Hebrew culture, there was really no difference.
Right.
What was the original Hebrew culture and Greek culture?
Yes.
Maybe not with Edomite Hebrew culture, which isn't really Hebrew, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Because Greek culture derived from Hebrew culture. There's simply no doubt about it because of the dispersion. You know, and of course, the Greek language, I think we discussed in a previous episode, I think it was Timothy, that the original Greek language sustained a hiatus. Apparently, correct me if I'm wrong, the original Greek actually derived from the Japhethites, and then it absorbed a lot of Hebrew influence, and that's what the Koine Greek or the general Greek of the Christ's time was. Would that be correct to say?
Well, I really think that the Athenian Greek was a distinct dialect.
Okay.
from Koine Greek. And one of the most common differences is a double T wherever you see a double S.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
It was a double T.
Huh.
Instead of a double, like the word Alasan, which is small, would be Alatan, what with a double T instead of a double S. But I think the Greek, you know, the ancient lexicography, that the ancient vocabulary that Homer and Hesiod had was quite different from the vocabulary of the Koine period or the Alexandrian period.
Yes.
I could read 90% of the passages in the New Testament. It was 100% probably be 18 months ago. I haven't had much time to read Greek lately. But I could read at least 90% of the New Testament without picking up a lexicon and translate it right on the fly, right on the spot.
Mm-hmm, okay.
But when I read Homer and Hesiod 600 years before,
right.
I'm in the lexicon every other word.
Right.
It's a lot
different.
The vocabulary is a lot different. And because I don't read a lot of that literature, I just don't have the vocabulary,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, but the Greek of the New Testament is primarily Koine Greek and therefore is to be distinguished from the period 600 years before when the Israelites began to influence Greek.
Well, yes, and I actually believe the Greek language itself is a bastard language.
Okay.
That it actually came from several different languages, one of them being the original Athenian Japhethite tongue.
Okay,
And another one being the Dorian tongue, the Dorian dialect, being the Danann dialect, and the Danans went into the Peloponnesus, 300 years before the Dorians did.
Mm-hmm.
The Danans went before 1450 BC with the Exodus, and the Dorians went in the Exodus. They were part of the tribe of Manasseh, it appears, for the most part, and the Dorians went, as Paul tells them, through the cloud and the sea with Moses, and they actually departed from Dor about 1100 BC, and that's 350, 400 years separated from the Danans that they arrived in the Peloponnesus.
Yeah, so we can understand that Paul's use of words is going to be somewhat different from that of the fishermen and tax collectors of Judea, okay? And so he's got a way more education. And he's going to have different definitions of words. So we're going to find out that there's conflicts, not necessarily in doctrine.
No, but only some conflicts in the nuance of how
Right, nuances of the words. Okay. All right. So verse 2, elect according, now he's again referring to the people of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia, elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, which means they can be nothing but Israelites. They cannot possibly be considered the elect if they aren't. And I'd say even if you define the elect as someone who has converted to Christianity, how much time have these people had to actually convert by this time? Isn't he actually still in the process of converting them, right? Their election is not based on belief. Their election is based on being Israelites.
Well right, and the problem with this translation, okay,
mm-hmm.
is that elect is an, here it is an adjective accompanying the dispersion in the Greek.
Okay.
The sojourners in the Greek.
I see. Okay.
So it's the elect sojourners.
Okay.
Where the King James translation
takes
that adjective elect, rips it off of sojourners.
And puts it after all those nouns?
And sticks it after all those nouns. Yes.
Wow. Amazing. Okay. Elect according to the foreknowledge of God the Father through sanctification of the Spirit. So that elect can be modified by through sanctification of the Spirit, right?
Well, right, and because elect here is an adjective modifying the noun sojourners.
Right.
And that's where it belongs, to the elect sojourners of the dispersion bunch of places, according to the foreknowledge of the Father.
Yeah, now that's real serious tampering with the structure of the
text. Well, yes, it is, and I'm looking at the NA27 as I speak, and I don't see any reason whatsoever in the manuscripts for the translators having done that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's just not there.
Okay. Through the sanctification of the Spirit, through obedience. There's the word obedience, folks, okay? You obey your whims, or you obey the laws of Yahweh. And sprinkling of the blood of Jesus Christ, grace to you and peace be multiplied. Blessed be God the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a lively hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Okay?
Now I got to speak about that begotten us again word.
Okay.
Right? Now the Greek word is anagenao. That's a verb. It's ana, and the verbal form of the word genos,
mm-hmm.
and that means
mm.
to be born,
mm-hmm.
right, of people,
yeah.
All right? That's what it means. Now, ana genao is most literally raised up,
mm-hmm.
okay? And that's how it probably should be translated here.
Okay.
Although all lexicons define the word as to be born again. and that's because it's a very obscure word outside of the New Testament.
Ah, okay.
It's not a common Greek word at all. It does appear a couple of times. Now the first century BC Greek philosopher Philodemus used this word to express the act of arousal or refreshment.
Okay.
All right? As
yeah,
a verb.
So,
it's a verb.
The word that occurred to me is rebirth.
But I wouldn't even go there.
Okay.
All right? Because it feeds their born-again
right.
attitude, which is why in my testament, when I translated it, I was more concerned with addressing the fallacies of the born-again crowd
right.
and being consistent with John chapter 3, as Christ clearly used a similar phrase, genethe, which is the same verb,
mm-hmm.
but a passive form of it, anothen, which is meaning, anothen means from above.
Right,
really.
You got
it,
from
it
above.
It means up. And of place,
mm-hmm.
and it means deriving from above
oh,
of
right.
place, all right? So that phrase clearly means born from above,
mm-hmm.
and also to remain consistent with the way Peter did use this same word below in 1 Peter 1:23,
okay.
where he said, and we'll see that when we get to it, but a better translation of this may be, and I have who is begotten us from above into a living hope through the resurrection of Yahshua
okay.
Christ.
Well, okay.
Which is very plausible, okay?
Yeah.
And that's the way Peter uses the word in 1:23, I think.
Right.
But also, it may have been more literally translated, simply, who according to his great mercy has revived us
okay.
to a living hope. And that's to revive us.
Right.
is that's the way the philosopher Philodemus uses this word.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, 150 years maybe before Peter.
Revive is much better, yes.
Right. And mm-hmm. and it's definitely not born again.
Right. Now, why is it? Because we've come across this several times. The King James consistently translates the expression from above as again. Well, what's going on here?
Well, that was Nicodemus's confusion.
Right, okay.
Oh, okay.
So he misunderstood.
Nicodemus was confused, and the church didn't learn the lesson.
The church is confused,
okay?
Too.
Nicodemus was obviously confused. It's obvious to me because I've studied the words, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the word Anna can mean in succession,
okay,
with some words. And it does, and in some contexts, it definitely does mean that,
mm-hmm.
okay? But it doesn't have to mean that.
Right.
And Christ in one place uses anagenesis, which could mean born again, but where Christ uses the phrase genese anothen in the same discourse,
uh-huh.
that defines what he means by anagenesis.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
And genese anothen is definitely you must be born
from above.
That's okay. What it means. Those two words mean you must be born from above. There's no disputing that.
Mm-hmm.
Anothen, which means
right.
from above of place, it means deriving from a place,
mm-hmm.
and that has to be up mm-hmm. or from above.
Right.
And even the King James, I think it's John 3:38. Yet, you know, much later, a few paragraphs after that discourse of Christ,
yes.
they translate that same word
correctly.
From above
right.
correctly,
yeah.
well, which they were forced to do in context.
Right.
Now,
okay.
now, there is another word which appears in Matthew,
mm-hmm.
okay? And that word is palin, not connected
not
with Sarah.
Palin.
Not Sarah Palin. Palin is actually a Greek word. It means again.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's where she got her name from. Oh, no, a Jew again. Oh, no.
Right.
I don't know if that's where she got her name.
Oh, not another Jew again.
But palin is a Greek word that means again. And
okay.
and Matthew uses a word, and it's in translate, in context, it means regeneration. I don't have the verse in my head off the top of my head.
Right.
But I know Matthew uses the word palin or palin genesia.
Okay.
And that means born again,
yeah,
literally.
Born again. Yes.
But it's not in any context yet, you know, that can be used as justifying a ritual of baptism and telling us that we're born again, so now we could be Christians when we're not
right.
even
right.
Israelites.
Well, we don't even know who we are or what we are, right?
Well, right. and that's, yeah, you know, the context Matthew uses palin genesia in, it
mm-hmm.
just means regeneration.
Right.
And that is, that word would correctly and literally mean born again.
Uh-huh.
But
anothen,
genese anothen and anagenesia do anagenao cannot mean
mm-hmm.
to be rebirthed. It's just not it's just not the context.
Okay. All right. Very good. Verse 4, to an inheritance. Now there's the word inheritance. Incorruptible. Okay, so only the Israelites were promised an inheritance. Okay. And the churches are constantly trying to generalize this inheritance to non-Israelites. And there's no possible way that if you and I have a covenant, let's for the sake of argument, assume that your father left you an estate and you and I are good buddies, okay, and I come over to your house all the time and your father dies and leaves you the estate and I say to you, I want some of that, okay? Do you have any obligation to give me any of that?
Well, right. You can't pick up my will, my
mm-hmm.
copy of my father's will, and imagine that you're the heir.
Right.
And that's what's going on in Judeo-Christianity.
That's right. That's right. They don't know the meaning of the word heir.
They don't know the meanings of any word,
right.
evidently, Greek or English.
Right, right. Okay, so this is Israelites' inheritance, and of course we've already identified these people as Israelites of the dispersion, to an inheritance incorruptible, which we are not yet, folks. We are not yet incorruptible. That's what's coming. That's the promise. That's the inheritance. And undefiled, and that fades not away, reserved in heaven for you. This is totally in accord with Paul's teachings on this subject. It's totally in accord with the book of Revelation, chapter 21. I mean, it's consistent. How can anybody say Paul is refuting or disputing Peter? He's not. Verse 5, who are kept by the power of God through faith to salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. Okay, hasn't been revealed yet. Wherein you greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, you are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, we're all saved. There's no trial. That's what.
Well, they don't want to believe there's a trial.
It's, you know, we can just ignore the trial. Well, we're saved. We were saved at the cross. That's what the churches teach. There's nothing happening now that's of any value. we have nothing to learn, is what they're saying, Bill.
Well, yes, they do, and it's a false religion. It's vacuous. It's empty. It's vain. It's vanity.
Right. It's totally vain. Yeah. That the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perishes, though it be tried with fire.
To me, this establishes, and there's more to this, but the trials of this life are the trials of fire,
right,
which we all must face being tested.
That's right.
And that's the trials of this world, all right? And Peter talks about this again in chapter 4, verse 12. Now comparing, we could compare 2 Corinthians 8, 2 and Hebrews 11, 36. And as we read last night, Ezekiel 21, 13, and we spoke about the same thing, that we would see this. I mentioned that when we got through Ezekiel 21, 13, I mentioned on a program last night that when we got to Peter, we would find out that the trials of our faith are the trials of this world, of this physical life, and Job 9:23. And the Catholics want to take these trials and move them to the afterlife. And in order that way, they can control people for themselves, and they can justify that control in this life, and that they really haven't been godly. The Catholics have really been a principal scourge of God's people.
Yes.
They're a vehicle for these trials.
Right.
We suffer trials in part through the Catholic Church, the Romish Church.
Right, right. Yeah, well, there was a time when, you know, I really believe that's what Paul was talking about when he says that the withholder, he who withholds, I think that's a bad translation, that he who holds back the Antichrist or the coming of the wicked one is actually the Catholic Church. And when the Catholic Church was overthrown, guess who came along? The Rothschilds. Okay. Now we're really in it. Okay. Well, let me start over verse 7. That the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perishes, though it be tried with fire, might be found to praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. There's that conditional might. And the Judeo-Christians who teach that we're all saved merely by believing in Jesus Christ, they always overlook these conditionals. They pretend that these don't exist.
If you overcome your trials, if you face them head on, if you tackle your trials and overcome them, then you would be found in praise and honor and dignity at the revelation of Christ.
Then you will be found worthy, and you will get a reward.
If you whine and piss and moan and cry like a Jew, then you probably don't have much coming.
Very good. Verse 8, whom having not seen you love, in whom though now you see him not, yet believing you rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory. Now, this sentence is really loaded because the average Judeo-Christian has no idea that these Israelites were expecting, they were anticipating the Messiah. They had an expectation that the Messiah would come, and this is why they believed, okay? It's not just this phony baloney Jesus that's being taught today. They were anticipating the literal flesh and blood Messiah. And so this is, and they understood from Paul, from Peter, from James, from Stephen, etc., that he had in fact come.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, Peter says, whom not having seen you love, and John 20:29, Christ says, Jesus says unto him, Thomas, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are they not having seen and yet have believed.
And
that's, you know, Peter is bestowing on these people that goodwill and blessing of Christ because not having seen him, that they fulfill that prophecy.
Right. So they understood from the apostles that the Messiah had come, and now it's the job of the apostles to explain what it all means. Okay, verse 9. Receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your soul. Now, this word end is often abused by the Judeo-Christians
as well. It's the result of their faith.
Mm-hmm.
It's acquiring the result of your faith, the preservation of your souls.
Okay, okay. And so it doesn't mean that your faith is no longer necessary.
Right.
Which is how to interpret this.
But the faith is it goes a lot. The faith is much more than a simple profession that I believe, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I mean, you could believe and go off and be a homosexual. Oh, how many millions of people do that today? Do they have faith? Hell no.
Yeah.
The faith is how you live every moment of your life.
That's
it's
right.
Much more than just a profession.
That's right. Yeah, or mere belief. Verse 10.
The result of your faith is the preservation of your souls. That's not the spirit. That's not the eternal spirit that's being spoken about.
Mm-hmm.
That's this life. And to carry on in this life, we see that the man who does the law shall have life by it. And we saw that several times in Ezekiel last night. If you practice the law, if you seek God's moral righteousness and justice, then that will preserve your life here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, verse 10. Of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that should come to you. Okay, verse 11 again. So he's informing them this. You know, this is what has happened. The Messiah has come. That's what all of Paul and John and James, that's what we're all telling you. Searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ, which is in them, did signify when it testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow. Okay, so.
Now if there's no salvation for Gentiles in the prophets, then there's no salvation for Gentiles.
That's right.
You won't find salvation for Gentiles in the prophets.
Yeah.
You won't find it in any of the prophets. There's no dispensationalism in the prophets.
That's right.
And if there's no dispensationalism in the prophets, according to Peter here, there is no dispensationalism.
Yeah.
It's a lie.
That's right.
Dispensationalism is a lie.
That's an absolute
lie. Gentiles translation is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
The salvation was promised to Israel. It was promised to the nations of Israel.
Right.
Paul delivered his message to those very nations, as he proves time and time again. And only a good study of classical history will prove Paul to be true and all the Paul bashers to be liars.
Right. Very good. Verse 12, to whom it was revealed that not to themselves, but to us. That word us is exclusive. He doesn't say to all the world, but to us. They did minister the things which are now reported to you by them and have preached the gospel to you with the Holy Ghost sent down from heaven, which things the angels desire to look into. Okay, so, you know, it's very exclusive language here when you're paying close attention.
Well, right. And let me say that Peter is comparing the prophets in their own time with the future generation of dispersed Israel, not the prophets. And the church has misconstrued this. He's not comparing the prophets as representing so-called Jews and some strange non-Israelite nations receiving these promises. That's not what the prophets wrote.
Mm-hmm.
The prophets wrote that Israel would receive these promises at a time far off when Yahweh would regather Israel, not physically, when he would regather Israel to himself. That happened with the spread of the gospel and the coming of Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good. To whom it was revealed that not to themselves, but to us, underlying to us, they did minister the things which are now reported to you by them that have preached the gospel to you with the Holy Ghost sent down from heaven, which things the angels desire to look into. Only our people had any such expectation.
Right. The prophets themselves consistently prophesy salvation and redemption
right.
for dispersed Israel exclusively.
Right. No non-Israelite had ever had any such expectation or even knowledge. So he can't be talking about non-Israelites. He can't be addressing non-Israelites. They would know what he was talking about. What's this guy Peter talking about? What expectation? Messiah? What's a Messiah? Right? Verse 13. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober.
That actually says being absolutely sober.
Being absolutely sober. I'll send this one to Clay Douglas. And hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Okay? There's more to come. There's more to come. Verse 14, as obedient children, not fashioning yourselves according to the former lusts in your ignorance.
Now, this is an important statement.
Okay.
As obedient children, not being conformed to the former desires in your ignorance, in my translation.
Mm-hmm.
This statement is only applicable to dispersed Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
If their ancestors didn't have those former desires that they were conformed to
right.
in ignorance, that's the story of the children of Israel.
That's right. Yeah, well, we've been covering that in Ezekiel.
well, right. And if your ancestors aren't the ones the prophets were talking about,
mm-hmm.
you can't be a Christian. There's no Christian. There's no promises for you.
Right. Right. Very good. As obedient children, not fashioning yourselves according to the former lusts in your, talking about our ancestors and, of course, the sinners of his own time. But as he which has called you is holy, so be you holy in all manner of conversation. Now we need to talk about this word holy.
Well first let me quote Isaiah 43:1. But now thus says Yahweh that created thee, O Jacob, and he that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed thee. I have called thee by thy name, thou art mine.
Mm-hmm.
Isaiah 45:4. For Jacob my servant's sake, Israel my elect, I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me.
Mm-hmm.
Now remember that the Israelites actually broke from the temple worship after the time, immediately after Solomon, under Rehoboam, right?
Mm-hmm.
He set up the golden calves because he didn't want the Israelites going up to the temple. These are statements showing where Peter says at the beginning of verse 15, but according to the Holy One who has called you. He's never called anybody but Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care how hard the dispensationalists look in the prophets, they're not going to find it.
Yeah.
Now,
mm-hmm.
since it is written that you must be holy because I am holy, that's a statement only written to and only written about Israel.
Yes.
It's a quote. It's a quote of Leviticus 11:44. It's a quote of Leviticus 19:2. Speak unto all the congregation of the children of Israel and say unto them, ye shall be holy, for I, Yahweh, your God, am holy.
Mm-hmm.
Leviticus 27, it's repeated again, and Leviticus 20:26. And ye shall be holy unto me, for I, Yahweh, your God, am holy, and have severed you from other people.
Mm-hmm.
Have separated you from
right.
other people.
Mm-hmm.
That you should be mine.
Yes.
Peter's message is entirely and exclusively to Israel.
Exclusive.
Is that when we see chapter 2 here, we'll see that Peter calls them a separate nation and a
mm-hmm.
holy race. And that's another quote from Leviticus chapter 19.
Right. Well, I just turned the page to verse 16, which is a quotation from Leviticus 11, because it is written, be you holy, for I am holy. Of course.
Well, right. That's what I was just quoting. I didn't quote 11:44. That's Leviticus 11:44.
Uh-huh.
But it's also Leviticus 19:2 I just read.
Uh-huh.
And Leviticus 20:26
right.
I just read. And it's repeated again at Leviticus 20, verse 7.
Yes. So the Israelites are holy because we are his children. We are directly the offspring through Adam of Yahweh. Okay? No other race can say that. Verse
no, and that word holy, the Greek word is Hagiazo is the verb, and hagios is the adjective, and it means separated, which Yahweh says, "For I have severed you," in that quote I just made.
Yeah.
And that means separated and dedicated to the purposes of a god in the Greek lexicon, or of Yahweh in the Hebrew Old Testament. The only people who have that claim are the people who came out of the loins of Isaac, who have anything to do with that.
Right.
Isaac was dedicated on an altar to Yahweh at the demand of Yahweh. He demanded that Isaac be dedicated on the altar to him, and then he wouldn't let Abraham actually kill Isaac in sacrifice, but he provided a substitute. But in Greek pagan religion, when you wanted to dedicate an altar, an object to a temple, and these temples were loaded with objects, silver and gold, they were always being looted by invading armies, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were loaded with objects that were dedicated by wealthy men to the temple in return for the hope of some favor or some blessing by this pagan god, right?
Yeah.
Now men would go bring the object to the temple and put it on the altar before the priest. And once it hit the altar, it became the property of the temple, for the temple to do anything it wanted with it. Once Isaac hit the altar, he became Yahweh's property.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
For Yahweh to do anything he wanted. So now that includes not only the Israelites who were in the loins of Isaac, but also the Edomites.
Yes.
And that's why Paul explains in Romans chapter 9 that two vessels were created from the same lump of clay.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul, in defending the elect of Israel and the rejection of Esau, Paul says, does the clay say to the potter, why do you make me this way?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can't, it's not ours to
question. Well, they can whine and moan about it.
well, right. The Israelites, as Paul explains, are the vessels of mercy. The Edomites are the vessels of destruction, and the lump of clay is Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody else in the world, if you descended from anybody but Isaac, you have no claim. You have no claim. You can't be holy. You can't be holy. And the Jews are actually dedicated to the purposes of Yahweh. They're our punishment for our sin.
Yes.
That's exactly what they are. They're our punishment for our sin.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And our separation from the other races, it's hidden in words such as holy. It's hidden in, well, actually it's not hidden in the word separated. But, of course, the Judeo-Christians ignore that when they see that word separate, or they think it means, well, we're spiritually separated, whatever that could possibly mean.
We can't imagine that Peter would quote this and then forget about where it says that he severed us from other people.
Right.
And then Peter quotes that in the next chapter.
That's right. Right.
And this is the New Testament.
Yeah. It's the New Testament, and both Peter, Paul, and James explicitly address their epistles to Israelites, and they consistently say we should remain separated from the rest of the world. They're constantly saying that. Verse 17. Oh, actually, let me read 16 again, because it is written, "Be you holy, for I am holy," quoting Yahweh in the Old Testament, verse 17. "And if you call on the Father, who without respect of persons judges according to every man's work, pass the time of your sojourning here in fear." There's a couple things here that Judeo-Christians need to learn. Number one.
Right. The first is what respect of persons.
Yes.
The respect for persons here, they want to make that a racial statement.
That's right.
And it has nothing to do with race at all.
Mm-hmm.
It has everything to do with the respect of the stature or status of persons. Oh, okay?
Yes.
And James defines this word in chapter 2 of his epistle, where he talks about respective persons and how we would give the rich man the nice seat in the assembly hall, make the poor man sit on the floor, and then it's the rich man who's the one that oppresses us and drags us before the courts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Just that summarizes exactly what James said. And Paul uses this phrase in the same way. It's the respect of the status of persons, which is what is meant by the Greek phrase.
Yes.
Has nothing to do with race. And the Judeo-Christians would say, see, God doesn't respect Christians. He doesn't respect persons. Anybody could be a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And they take the whole rest of the Bible and throw it out.
That's right. That's right. So, and sojourning here in fear. So what we have here is, you know, you should be in fear and trembling of what befalls you if you are not an obedient Israelite, right?
Now, Peter actually says you must conduct yourselves in fear for the time of your sojourn.
Mm-hmm.
It's the noun again.
Okay.
Not a verb. And our sojourn is obviously this worldly life.
Right.
As the word was also used in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And this defines Peter's use of the word sojourner in the opening line of his epistle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the way he uses it.
Yeah. So this verse, kills two of their false beliefs. Number one, it's not a racist or racial or anti-racist statement. It's not that at all.
Well, right. And James chapter 2 defines that perfectly.
And it totally debunks their false vanity in pretending that they're saved and have nothing to fear. Okay? Verse 18. For as much as you know that you were not redeemed with corruptible things, such as silver and gold, nor the Levitical rituals, from your vain conversation received by tradition from your fathers. Okay, there was a lot of vanity going on in these days, right? Still is today, right? Verse 19, but with the precious blood of Christ as a lamb without blemish and without spot, he was sinless, who verily was foreordained before the foundation of the world, but was manifest in these last times for you. Any comments on these last couple of verses?
Well, before the foundation of society, you know, Yahweh has to have foreknown all things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the first promise of salvation is actually found in Genesis 3:23.
Mm-hmm.
And applies to the Adamic race generally, but it's the Adamic race only. And that's unless the man reach out his hand and grasp the tree of life and live forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an allusion to Christ.
Yes.
who says that he is the tree of life.
Mm-hmm.
He is the true vine.
Right, right. Okay, very good. Verse 21, who by him do believe in God that raised him up from the dead and gave him glory, that your faith and hope might be in God, seeing you have purified your souls in obeying. Okay, this hasn't happened yet. Seeing you have purified your souls in obeying the truth, there's obedience again, through the Spirit to unfeigned love of the brethren, see that you love one another with a pure heart fervently. There's a lot of feigned love out there.
Well, right. And I like to read Galatians 5:13.
Okay.
Because Paul puts this stress on brotherly love, and a lot of people fault him for it, and that's just crazy, right?
Yeah.
For brethren, ye have been called unto liberty, only use liberty not for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
Here Peter is demanding brotherly love without hypocrisy.
Right.
From of a pure heart, you should love one another earnestly.
Yeah.
And a love for one another is to serve one another. It's more than a simple, I love my brother. Right, and you go on and go gambling and whoring and drinking and destroying your community because of your behavior.
Yes, yes. Very good. Verse 23, being born again. What do we got going here?
Well, this is being engendered from above in my translation. It's the same word, anagenao. If you want to translate it born again, that's fine with me, but it's not right.
Yeah.
It's being gendered from above.
Right.
Not from corruptible parentage, but from incorruptible by the word of Yahweh who lives and abides.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to quote a couple of quotes from Paul to explain this. Okay, what Peter could mean about being gendered from above, not from corruptible parentage, but from incorruptible. Now, here's the key. By the word of Yahweh. In other words, you have to be engendered according to the word of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that means.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. And Paul explains that the spirit is in our DNA. And I believe that,
absolutely.
That this is the correct interpretation of 1 Corinthians 15:42 through 49. You'll have to bear with me for a few minutes. I'm going to be a few minutes here.
Okay.
Verse 42, I'm going to quote my translation. In this way also is the restoration of the dead. It is sown in decay. It is raised in incorruption. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in honor. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual. Now we're going to define this in a minute. That doesn't include everybody that has a body. And just as it is written, the first man, Adam, came into a living soul.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you're not an Adamite, they're the natural bodies he's talking about.
Right.
If you don't have that body, you're not part of this book. The last Adam into a life-producing spirit. But the spiritual was not first, rather the natural, then the spiritual. The first man from out of the earth of soil, the second man from out of heaven. Now there's a key to this. As he of soil, such as also those who are of soil, and as he in heaven, such as those who are in heaven. And just as we have borne the likeness of that of soil, we shall also bear the likeness of that of heaven. Now this, I believe, is an allegory for Genesis 2:7, that Adam's body was created first, and then the spirit was implanted in him. Paul's using that as an allegory and comparing it to the first Adam and to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Now Paul explains how to be engendered of incorruptible parentage by the word of Yahweh,
mm-hmm.
as Philippians 2, verses 14 through 16.
Yeah.
Do all things apart from murmuring and disputing, that you would be perfect and with unmixed blood, blameless children of Yahweh in the midst of a race crooked and perverted, among whom you appear as luminaries in the society and upholding the word of life. Kind after kind, for a boast with me in the day of Christ, that not in vain have I run, nor in vain have I labored. Now, for luminaries, we'll go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 35 to 42. But some will say, how are the dead raised? And this is the beginning part of what I had just read about the spirit and the body, right?
Yeah.
But some will say, how are the dead raised, and with what sort of body will they come? Fools, that which you sow, is it not made alive, even if it may die? And that which you sow is not the body that you sow that will be producing itself, but a bare grain, whether, for example, of wheat or of any of the rest. And Yahweh gives to it a body just as he has willed, and to each one of those seeds its own body. Not all flesh is the same flesh, but one flesh of man and another flesh of beasts, and another of birds, and another of fish, and bodies in heaven, and bodies on earth. But the difference is the effulgence of the heavenly, and different is that of the earthly. What Paul's saying here is, you know, he talks about luminaries appearing as luminaries in the society in Philippians 2, 14 through 16. And then he compares our earthly bodies and our spiritual bodies as having a different effulgence in 1 Corinthians 15, and I believe we have to put two and two together and see that the way to be born a luminary in the society is to keep your race pure and to be born upholding the word of life, or as Peter puts it here, by the word of Yahweh, being engendered from above, not from corruptible parentage, but from incorruptible by the word of Yahweh, who lives and abides. Now the church turns this whole thing around, and they say that if you follow the word, you're born from above.
Right.
No, if you follow the word, if you believe the word, you're born from above spiritually, no matter how you're born on earth.
Right.
It is what the church teaches.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is that if your parents follow the word, you may be born from above as long as they are.
Right.
That's the truth.
Right.
Of not from corruptible parentage, but from incorruptible parentage.
That's right. Right. Very
and good. And that word is translated seed in the King James, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But the word has to be distinguished from offspring because it's the Greek word. It's not sperma. It's spora. And that means parentage in Greek.
Okay.
That's how they saw the difference between a seed and a spore.
Okay.
That they used the word spore to describe parentage,
mm-hmm.
where you came from. And
well, okay, so it means heritage, but still it means heritage of the same race.
Well, absolutely. It's corrupt. There's corruptible parentage and there's incorruptible parentage.
Right, right.
And if you're born according to the word, then you'll be born of incorruptible parentage, because your parents have obeyed the word.
Yes. Okay, very good. Let me repeat verse 23. Being born from above, not of corruptible seed, that makes perfect sense, but of incorruptible, by the word of God, which lives and abides forever. What's your exact translation again?
Being engendered from above,
mm-hmm.
not from corruptible parentage,
mm-hmm.
but from incorruptible, by the word of Yahweh who lives and abides.
Okay, very good. Verse 24, for all flesh is as grass. Now, of course, again, he's addressing Israelites, okay? Our flesh is, it's not true that just because we're Israelites, white does not make right, okay? And we do not teach that in Christian identity. You have to follow Yahweh's law.
Well, right. Obedience makes
mm-hmm.
right. And obedience is only necessary
right.
if you're white.
Yes. And then,
because wolves are supposed to act like wolves.
Yeah. In addition, you also have to accept the sacrifice of Jesus Christ as he offered himself to you as an Israelite. If you're a white person who does not accept that, you're in just as much trouble as a Jew. Because half the white nationalists I know do not believe in Jesus Christ and think he's a Jew on a stick.
Well, they may be the Jews.
Right. Right. For all flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man, that is fleshly man, as the flower of grass. The grass withers, and the flower thereof falls away. So there's a whole lot more to it than just race. Verse 25. But the word of Yahweh endures forever. And, of course, this is taken from the Old Testament from numerous passages. And this is the word by which the gospel is preached to you. Is there any doubt here, Bill, that Peter is inspired by the Old Testament?
Well, this whole epistle has been inspired by the Old Testament.
Right.
And this whole epistle is explaining that Christianity is the Old Testament. The Old Testament is Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
It's
right.
Christianity before Christ.
It's Christianity,
and that Christ is the fulfillment and their acceptance of the gospel. The dispersion of Israel accepts the gospel. That's the fulfillment of the prophets.
Yes.
That Yahweh said that he would regather his people.
Right.
They weren't regathered to get on a boat and go back to Palestine. 2 Samuel 7:10, or I'm sorry, it's 1 Samuel 7:10, proves that is a boneheaded idea.
Right. Yes.
Okay. And there are other scriptures also. However, they were regathered to Yahweh under the new name which he gave them, which is Christ, Christian.
Right. Christian. Exactly. Exactly. Of course, that word Messiah being translated into English. Right.
And it took 1,000 years, and then as soon as the Jesuits
right.
weaseled their way in, we
right.
started bringing strangers into the covenant.
That's right, that's
and,
right.
And
exactly.
that wasn't supposed to be either. I mean, Yahweh, don't get me wrong, Yahshua Christ predicted, he prophesied universalism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
not
he
that
prophesied.
We should be universalists, he just predicted that it would come.
He knew it was inevitable.
Right.
Yeah, you know, he talked about the kingdom of heaven is like a net when cast in the sea, pulls up every kind of fish.
Right.
And then the good fish and the bad fish are separated.
Yeah, that's right. There's that word separation.
And that word for good and bad kind is the word genos, and it means race is what it means. And the good species of fish are kept. And the bad species of fish, they're not even thrown back into the sea. They're
yeah.
thrown on the shore.
Right.
Now, what happens to fish tossed aside on the shore?
The vultures.
Well, vultures, and they bake in the sun and die, right?
Yes,
I mean,
right.
it doesn't take long.
that reminds me of a really good criticism of Judaism, okay, and of Jews in general. I forget who wrote this, but he was from far away. He looked upon the seashore from up somewhere up on high, right, from a hill, and there was a bright, shiny object on the seashore, and it was attracting his attention. It looked so great because it was glistening so bright in the sun. But the closer he got, he started to smell the stink, right? And so that glistening object was nothing but a dead fish, right? Okay. This is how you can be fooled, folks. Chapter 2, actually, let me repeat verse 25 before we go on to chapter 2. But the word of Yahweh endures forever. This includes the Old Testament. And this is the word by which the gospel is preached to you. And we pointed out numerous times, Bill, in our discussion of Paul, that he's constantly quoting the Old Testament.
Paul,
they had no other scriptures to teach from.
Absolutely. All of Paul's letters are probably half Old Testament. I don't know. There's an incredible amount of Old Testament quotes in Paul.
Yes.
And they're all in context. And once you see them,
yes,
you go back and look at what Paul was reading. He wasn't taking things out of context and flying off the handle.
Right.
He was quoting things in perfect context,
right,
that proved again and again,
right,
that the people he was addressing were the children of Israel.
Right, right. And now we can see, I think, you know, one of the things that is patently obvious from this entire series on the New Testament is that if you lack historical perspective about the dispersed Israelites and their presence in Asia Minor, Europe, Northern Africa, Mesopotamia, etc., if you don't understand that whole area, otherwise known as the Greco-Roman world, was populated by Israelites of the dispersion, if you don't know that, if you don't have that historical information, then you're going to assume, as the Jews have been telling us, that those people are so-called Gentiles, meaning non-Israelites, and that is patently false. That is an absolutely false historical perspective, and this is why the Jews deny that the scattered 10 tribes still exist. And this is why the Judeo-Christians deny that we still exist.
Well, right, but we have two witnesses. Well, we have two easy witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we have Josephus, who wrote about the 10 tribes being across the Euphrates,
right,
in innumerable numbers.
Right.
Who's on the other side of Euphrates from Josephus? The
right.
Scythians and the Parthians.
Right.
Oh, okay. The second witness
is
James.
Right.
James, to the 12 tribes scattered abroad.
Yes.
I mean,
yes. Well, you know what?
To be a Jew is to be contrary to all scripture.
That's right.
When Christians wake the hell up, read the epistles of John, and put off the works of the devil, and
right,
put the Jews in the closet where they belong,
yes,
and stop reading their garbage, and stop listening to their lies, then they might be able to find out the truth.
Right. Well, I just recently bought a Judeo-Christian study Bible. And they translated James 1:1 not as to the 12 tribes scattered abroad, but to our Jewish brothers scattered abroad.
Well, that's nothing more perverse than that.
Right.
Because that's not a translation. That's not even a translation. That's
right.
Not
that's,
anything close to
that's
a translation.
Pure deception.
I'd like to stand behind that guy with a bat as he was writing this word.
Right.
That's the only thing I could imagine might straighten
yeah,
out.
Well, exactly. And well, he's going to get a bat in the head. You know, when Yahshua Messiah comes for the second time, he's going to get a bat in the head. There's no doubt about it. But that's what they're doing. They're redefining words so that the Jewish paradigm, namely the false dichotomy between Jews and Gentiles, can never be questioned. Okay? Because that's the language that's employed in the scriptures. It's deception, folks. It's absolute deception. The Jews had no part in writing the Old Testament. The Jews were not present at Mount Sinai. They were not in Egypt. They were not in the Babylonian captivity, as they admit in John 8:44. We were never in bondage to any man, right?
Well, I'm sure they may have been in Egypt. The Pharaoh was part
right.
of it, right? And he probably had a whole court
exactly.
full of Edomites and Hittites as
right.
part
right.
of it.
Yeah, and that Pharaoh did not know Joseph.
If the Jews were in Egypt, they were the ones that got Pharaoh to
right.
To
yeah, and there's evidence that they were part Hittites. Yeah,
yes.
You're absolutely right. Yes. Okay. Very good. Now, chapter 2, 1 Peter, verse 1. Wherefore, laying aside all malice and all guile, did not Yahshua Messiah refer to the eunuch from Ethiopia as a guileless?
Well, no, that's anachronistic. That? The eunuch was from Philip. He did see an Israelite and proclaimed, "Behold, an Israelite in whom there is no guile."
Right.
And he made that announcement on site, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very clear. It's in 1 John 47, and it's spoken of Nathanael.
Yes. Okay. An Israelite in whom there is no guile. Okay. And also that be therefore wise as serpents, yet gentle as doves. That word gentle can also be translated as guileless. Guileless as doves. We are to be without guile. You know, we don't need, especially toward our brethren, okay? And if we're motivated by guile, then we're going to make mistakes. So let's continue here. I'm going to read verse 1. Wherefore, laying aside all malice and all guile and hypocrisies and envies and all evil speaking. Well, there's no way a Jew can fulfill any of these conditions.
Well, right, he's telling us, stop acting like Jews.
Yeah, right. I mean, Judaism is hypocrisy personified.
And slander personified.
Yes. Verse 2, as newborn babes desire the sincere milk of the word, that you may grow thereby, this sentence structure is bad.
I have quotes here because it appears to be a quote of some unknown
scripture,
right?
Yes.
It really does. If you taste that the Lord or the Prince is benevolent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in other words, if you have tasted this milk, then you will find the graciousness.
Well, all right.
The
if
Lord.
You experience that Christ is really benevolent, and you know his yoke is light.
Yeah,
and it really is. It's easy to follow the
right,
law.
Right.
I mean, we can all sin at any time. Don't get me wrong. I'm probably
mm-hmm.
number one. But we, it's easy to follow the basic precepts of the
right,
law.
Yeah.
It's
so,
very easy.
Right,
the Ten Commandments: don't commit fornication. That's cake. I mean,
yeah.
And you can't you can't violate any of the precepts of the Levitical law even if you follow the Ten Commandments.
Right.
And love your brother.
Yes. Joe says, unfortunately, the milk has been pasteurized by the Jew.
Well, right.
Exactly
yeah.
right. Thank you, Joe. All right. To whom coming as to a living stone, a living foundation.
Right. And that is, you know, here the word is lithos.
Okay.
It's not Petros. Because Peter's name really means stone.
Okay.
All right. Yeah,
yes.
You know, Christ, you know, when Christ makes the announcement concerning Peter, that his name would be Petros, he's saying that his foundation, his church would be founded on Petra. He's saying, you are a Petros. And then he's
mm-hmm.
saying that the church, that his assembly would be founded on Petra. And Petra is bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
And Petros is a stone. Okay? He's not giving Peter the honor of being the first pope.
Right.
What he's doing is he's saying, you are a stone.
Mm-hmm.
My real assembly will be founded on bedrock.
Yes.
In other words, you're just a stone.
Right.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And the real assembly of Yahweh will be founded on bedrock.
Yes.
And that's a serious distinction there
right.
that English readers just miss because nobody translates it right.
Yeah.
And nobody translates it right because they all want to uphold the Romish lie.
Right.
Now, the... Here Peter's using the word lithos, which is really a synonym with Petros, but lithos is also used, where Petros is not, of hewn blocks of stone.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a stone that you throw just like a Petros or a small rock, but it's
right.
also used of hewn blocks of stone, and that's the allusion being made here.
Right.
It is the allusion to Christ being the chief cornerstone,
right.
which is again lithos, and we'll see
yeah.
that in the verses.
Yeah, and Commander McBragg brings up the stone kingdom of Daniel. Obviously, we're talking about true Christianity, which in Daniel is prophesied will never die. It will never die.
Well, okay. As Paul drew the illusion often, we're all stones in the same building.
Right.
The real church of God
mm-hmm.
is made of us.
Made without
hands. We are each true Israelite Christian is a stone
right.
in that building.
We are the church.
Yes.
Not the bricks and mortar and pews and tile.
Well,
roofing.
Because church, you know, if you want to use the word church, and we all get trapped up in it, right?
Yes.
It is the assembly of God, and the assembly is the people,
right.
his people,
mm-hmm.
that he called.
Right, right.
Not the people that try to call him.
That's right, yeah.
And they all have the wrong number.
And it's certainly not the preachers who are all, almost without exception, every Judeo-Christian denomination is totally distorting these words, you know, so that it can attract more butts in their pews.
Well, right. And the Greek word is ecclesia, and ecclesia literally means from a calling.
Mm-hmm.
That's the literal meaning of the word.
There we have the holy ones again, the
right.
called out ones.
Well, exactly. That's exactly why people translate it the called out ones.
Yes.
Because that's the only way to translate it when it's applied to a group of people.
All right.
Now, ecclesia was a political word in Athens.
Okay.
Okay. The ecclesia of Athens were the men of age who were citizens.
Okay.
You had to first be a man of age. Then you had to second be a citizen,
okay,
and third be one of the citizens who were regularly chosen to appear in the assembly at Athens.
Right,
you had to be admitted, more or less,
an elector. Yeah.
Well, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It was a specific group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Not anybody could move to Athens and become a member of the ecclesia.
But, Bill, anybody can become a Christian or say, I'm a Christian, right?
That they might be able to say it, but that don't make them it.
That's right. That's right. Very good. Very good. So, to whom coming as to a living stone, rejected of men, but chosen of God and precious. You also, he's comparing us to Christ, as lively stones are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, not just the bishops and the rectors and the peoples who have been ordained into some denomination. He's talking about the all Israelites.
None of those people are legitimate Christian
That's right.
bishops, and none of those people are legitimate Christian ministers, because legitimate Christian bishops, and this is the and legitimate Christian ministers, and this is the example right from Acts chapter 6, and Paul carried this example with him all throughout his epistles and throughout the Acts.
Mm-hmm.
Were chosen by the local assembly.
Right.
When you look at Acts 6, right, the people, the Greeks, the Hellenists and the Hebraists, all right,
mm-hmm.
the Judeans who mimicked the Greek customs and the Judean traditionalists who clung to the traditional Hebrew customs, there was a division among them, and the Hellenist Judeans, they thought that their widows and orphans weren't getting taken care of as well as the Hebraist Judean.
Right.
That's the dispute in Acts 6. So what did the apostles do? They appointed seven men over the assembly, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, wrong. What they did was they told the people to choose seven men.
Right.
That's the first example.
Right.
And Paul uses language
mm-hmm.
all throughout his epistles that
right.
shows that they did that same thing.
Yes.
They never appointed, ordained anybody over an assembly.
Yes.
They had the people choose their bishops. They had the people choose their ministers.
Mm-hmm.
They had the people choose who would serve them. Paul states that explicitly many times. There's no Catholicism.
Right.
There's no Presbyterianism or Episcopalianism
right.
or in the Scripture,
right.
period.
I was
in
just
Paul's letters
say.
In the Acts, in Peter's letters in James, you won't find it.
I was just getting ready to say, no Catholic laity ever selected the priest who was dictating to them.
Right.
It's also been appointed by the papacy, the Antichrist papacy. Yes.
Well, right. That's why none of them are legitimate.
They're right.
And what do the illegitimate ones do? They raid the panties of our daughters and our sons.
Right.
That's what they do. They raid the houses of our
yeah.
widows and enrich
right.
themselves.
And they
destroy our children
taxes.
With their sexual perversion.
Yeah.
That's what they do. And they're being forced on these assemblies, and the assemblies accept it. If they ever read their Bibles, they wouldn't have to put up with these perverts.
That's right. That's right. That's why I keep telling people, stay out of the Judeo-Christian churches. They're all illegitimate. They're all Baal worship. They're all houses of Baal worship, every last one of them. Okay? All right. Again, you also, as lively stones, are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood. He's talking about us. To offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. We are the temple.
I like to quote Paul here.
Okay.
1 Timothy 6:18 and 19. That they do good and that they be rich in good works,
mm-hmm.
ready to distribute, ready to communicate, which means share,
yes.
laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come,
mm-hmm.
that they may lay hold on eternal life.
Right.
And 2 Timothy 3:17,
mm-hmm.
that the man of God may be perfect, furnished,
right.
thoroughly furnished unto all good works.
Right.
And that's what Peter's talking about here. Living stones offer spiritual sacrifices. Paul called that good works,
mm-hmm.
acceptable to Yahweh through Yahshua Christ.
Yes. Yeah. And so the foundation that we are supposed to put ourselves upon is, what did Jesus say? If you love me, keep my commandments. Okay, that's the foundation. He never changed that, and neither did Paul. Paul never changed that either. And you know, we haven't had time today to discuss it, but you know, we can probably talk about, you know, the Levitical sacrifices. And you know, this actually is really the first allusion to it here in verse 5, although, you know, he's suggesting it's spiritual sacrifice. He doesn't say instead of Levitical blood rituals. He doesn't say that, but that's what he's alluding to, that we're supposed to offer spiritual sacrifices.
Well, absolutely, because each of us are kings and priests, as was
right.
Yahweh's initial plan for us and outlined in the Exodus.
Yes.
We're each kings and priests over our own household.
Yes.
And we're each kings and priests because that ensures that we're all equals.
Okay.
It solidifies the idea that we are all equals. We really only have one king and one priest,
mm-hmm.
and that's Yahshua Christ.
Right, yeah. And that's exactly what our founding fathers believed. Right?
Well, that's why they revolted.
All Adamites are created equal.
that's why they revolted.
That's right.
You know, when you really look at the writings of Jefferson and the writings of George Mason, who had a lot of influence over Jefferson,
mm-hmm.
and the other earlier noblemen, well, Jefferson really meant all men are equal in the eyes of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the English nobility, that they could trounce all over the common man,
right.
and never have to pay a penalty.
Yeah, the debtor's court was their favorite weapon. Yeah.
Well, right.
Mm-hmm.
And another one was, I don't know how prominent it was in England. I know it was prominent in Germany and some other places, the right of the first knight.
Right.
Of a
feudalism, right.
Right.
He gets to deflower your wife before you do. That's
yes.
Right.
Yes. And you know, that goes all the way back to Babylon, you know.
Uh-huh.
That is actually explicitly stated in the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Right. Right. That's kind of like the Muslim, you know, 72 virgins when you die. Right. Except it's here on earth. Right.
Well, the founding fathers wanted nothing to do
right.
with the nobility and their oppression of the people.
Right, right. And so here, and obviously Paul teaches the same thing, that we are supposed to elect or select our priesthood from among ourselves, our elders from among ourselves. They are not to be appointed for us by any, you know, hierarchy of denominational priesthoods, okay? We are the priests. They are not. This is what the average Christian simply does not understand.
There's no such thing as a Christian priesthood.
There's no such thing as a Catholic priest.
And the words don't appear. Christian priests do not appear until the Council of Nicaea.
Right, right, yeah. We are supposed to serve one another. And the elders of the community are first and foremost servants of the people who have selected them. That's how it's supposed to work. Didn't Jesus say, I came to serve you?
Well,
that's
yes,
the mentality.
He consistently made that illustration.
Right.
And yet these popes and bishops. And,
yeah, they rule over.
And even the pastor, the local parish pastors are really, the people all play the sycophant and kiss their asses.
That's
literally.
Right.
I've seen it time and time again back in Jersey.
Sure.
When I was a kid, you know, people loved to talk to these priests and get a moment of their time so that they could play the sycophant.
Right.
And it's just like the Pharisees and Christ's description of them in Matthew 23.
That's right.
How they love the esteem of people. They love to be treated like royalty. They love the first seats in the banquets, the best seats in the markets. They love to be called rabbi. And inside, mm-hmm. they're ravening wolves that are pillaging the estates of widows and the children of the innocent.
Yes. Oh, man. Yeah, it's just amazing how the true message of scriptures has been utterly distorted by, you know, and as much as we in identity badmouth the Jews, it's really our own priests, our so-called priests, the people who have appointed themselves as priests over us.
Well, they've made themselves like the rabbis.
That's
they've made
right.
themselves like Jews.
That's right. Okay. All right, so that takes us through part one of First Peter, and I had a feeling that we weren't going to zip through Peter.
Well, I was ready for three chapters tonight. We didn't even do half of that.
Right.
I could have been ready for tonight's show by 10 o'clock this morning.
Because there's so much here that has been obviously distorted, and, you know, of course, what we're dealing with is false interpretations of exclusive language, and again, as you've been pointing out, they have restructured sentences, changing adjectives into verbs, nouns into verbs, and vice versa, so that they can rewrite sentences to mean something completely different from what they really say.
All the time.
Yes. Amazing.
It's constant in Paul, but it also occurs in Peter and James and in the Gospels.
Yes. Very good. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening. This has been Yahweh's Covenant People, part one of First Peter. I want to invite you all to join me and Greg Howard tomorrow at noon Eastern. We're going to be doing a two-part series on the testaments of the 12 patriarchs. That ought to be outstanding. And a lot of people probably never even heard of that document. And so we'll be doing two shows on that. Bill, you got anything going tomorrow?
Well, I'm going to listen to your program, and tomorrow my garden needs some serious attention. I do not have a program with Sword Brethren tomorrow night.
Okay.
He is actually career-seeking, and he's traveling, so I'm going to – my garden has been wanting attention for a couple of weeks now. It needs it.
Right,
My raspberries have gotten so tall. They're like 9 feet tall.
Oh, really?
And now they're all over my tomato plants. They just flopped over. I have to get some fencing and – I'm going to take some fencing and kind of tie them up, right?
Right. Are they producing any raspberries?
Well, they have a million flowers. I mean, I should have a million raspberries by September.
Okay. All right. Save some for me in October. Okay. Very good. All right. Thank you, Bill. Okay.
Thank
you all for listening tonight. This is Pastor Eli James, Yahweh's Covenant People. Yahweh bless everybody.